I don't need you to tell me that. Because I tell myself that every day. But at least I am not a tweaked out, fucked out crystal queen.
Still queer as folk.
You're listening to the Still Queer as Folk podcast, where each week we take down an episode of Showtime's Queer as Folk TV show to find out if it still holds up 15 years later. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Before we get started, we need to ask you a favor, and that's to click the 5-star rating on whatever app you're listening to us. It really helps us out a lot.
And you can also follow up on our discussions about today's episode on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at StillQueerAF.
This episode is called Tweaked Out, Fucked Out, Crystal Queen. It's episode number 13 of season 3, the penultimate episode of the season.
Tweaked Out, Fucked Out, Crystal Queen first aired in the U.S. on June 15th, 2003.
It was directed by Alex Chappell, his 6 of 8 Queer as Folk episodes. He's also directed some of my other favorite shows like Law & Order, Law & Order Criminal Intent, Law & Order SVU, Stargate Universe, The Americans, Chicago Fire, Blue Bloods, and Elementary. Alex Chappell is a heavyweight, and I've given positive reviews to all of his Queer as Folk episodes so far.
Knowing that he directed Law & Order episodes makes the A story to this episode make a whole lot of more sense.
I see in my notes here that I said Law & Order. Whoops.
Seeger produced 20 episodes of the show and wrote 8 of them.
Here's what happened in Tweaked Out, Fucked Out, Crystal Queen from Queer as Folk, the book.
Justin appears in front of a school disciplinary committee to apologize for his behavior at the ad agency, but refuses to apologize to Stockwell and gets suspended.
Hunter shows up with a condom full of cop sperm, as well as the alleged murderer's name, who turns out to be Stockwell's former partner.
Enter Law & Order theme. Emmett caters Ted's orgy, but leaves before the festivities start, thus angering Ted and causing him to end the relationship.
I wish somebody would cater my orgies.
I would just order takeout.
It's funny because I don't know that was really planned as an orgy.
It was just a party. So, right. But we'll get into it.
Cater my orgy. Melanie and Lindsay invite Emmett to stay with them after forgiving each other for Ted-inspired tensions. Ooh. This is quite an episode.
Yes, it is.
Surprisingly, Tweaked Out, Fucked Out, Crystal Queen had an IMDb rating of 7.6.
Oh.
12% of the people rating the show gave it a 1. They really didn't like it. Either they were just trolling.
I was going to say, I was wondering if it was because they actually did not like the episode or they did not like the content of the episode, particularly when it comes to Ted's situation.
Well, the demographic with the highest rating for this episode was male, 18 to 29, with an 8.5 average rating.
Well, that age group does like an orgy scene.
It resonated well with the 18 to 29-year-olds. So to get this episode started, I've been using the term private dick for a while. This intro was like so perfectly private dick noir. See?
Yes, it was.
Loved it.
Yes, we have this, you know, look of Brian overseeing Pittsburgh, the city, and smoking a cigarette. And I actually do like that image of the large window and he's just taking in the city.
It was a dark and rainy night in the city. It's a little like the city by the rivers.
It's a little like Batman looking over Gotham.
That was a bit of a new shot for us. We'd never really had that kind of wide angle panoramic shot of Brian's loft. And so we see his very beautiful arched window.
Yeah, I had no idea that window existed the way it did. I mean, it was very...
Noir?
the view of seeing Brian, it made him seem almost like the city was very grand and he was just one little piece of it. The perspective of it, that's the phrase I'm looking for. The perspective of that shot was fascinating to me.
Yeah, it's really nice. And surprisingly, it looked great because that's obviously not Pittsburgh. This is on a soundstage. It was a really, really nice matte painting.
Yeah, it was very beautiful. And then there's Justin, of course, in his tidy whities.
Yeah, they weren't quite as tight as I would want them to be, though. They were a little saggy, I think.
Well, they were saggy when he auditioned to be a dancer at Babylon 2, so.
Those Levi briefs that he had on, that off-white color. Like he dropped his white ones into a load of colored clothes.
And thought, eh.
Yeah. So once again, somebody gets all the way up to Brian's door. complete with Kenneth Reichert's jizz. And that's our hero, Hunter.
With a very full condom.
What do you want besides that?
I brought you this.
It's very thoughtful of you. Did you make it yourself?
It's the cops.
You fuck the cop?
You said you needed DNA.
A cigarette butt would have sufficed.
He doesn't smoke.
The way he was dangling it, I kept thinking he was going to like smack Brian on the face with it or something.
I feel like there is just way too much comedy going on in this intro. There were great lines from Hunter. They go over to Ben and Michael's house and they're just over the top hysterical. I just found some of the humor distracting in what could have been a much more serious and ominous scene. Instead, it's like, la 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 la, I've got the condom. La 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 la, let's go.
Swing, 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 yeah. Swing, smack, smack, yeah.
Brian puts it into a Ziploc baggie.
I also love how territorial Hunter is over Brian because yeah. He thinks Justin's just another hustler.
So how about expressing your appreciation?
Ooh, he already has 3 times with me.
What do you bother with that for? How much is he charging you?
100? He refuses to pay, though.
I don't blame him. I wouldn't give you $10.
Okay, I think it's time someone was tucked in bed. And not mine.
And I was like, I didn't think of that.
Yes, he's like, how much did you pay for him? And he's like,
$100? Yeah.
And I love that Brian and Justin have this little banter going on. Like, okay, we're going to humor Hunter for like a quick second. And they kind of they're making light of it. So it's really funny to me that Hunter is a little bit dim and not picking up that they know each other.
Yeah, they are dating. I mean, granted, Justin's only like 1.5, 2 years older than Hunter.
Yes. And so it's funny. What is Hunter says something about like, yeah, I wouldn't even pay $10 for you. Like, Jesus, Hunter.
Yeah, I love the comedy. I just wish it would have been someplace else in the story.
Sure. And I 100% agree that when they get to, when Brian brings Hunter back to Ben and Michael's and they're like screaming.
Yeah, I thought was a little out of character, especially for Ben, because Ben is supposed to be the Zen professor. I mean, I get why they were yelling and screaming, but it was just so over the top.
Yes, I thought it was a lot more comedic than maybe it was intended. I think what they wanted to go for was to somehow have Hunter understand the dangerous position he put himself in by offering himself to Reichert the way he did. But I love that Hunter countered with that. It's like, there's always a chance I could be killed.
That's true. He had good lines. He had great comebacks and everything.
Yes, his counter arguments to Ben and Michael in that moment was really strong. I mean, I was having trouble saying, Hunter's got a point, though.
Let's not lose focus here. You need to understand that what you did was extremely dangerous.
This guy could have killed you.
They all could.
Well, if you know that, then why do you do it?
I have low self-esteem. I was sexualized at too early an age. It's exciting, fun, and a great way to make non-reportable income.
I did like the notion that Brian took him home and delivered him back into the safety of Michael and Ben. There's just something cute about that and something, I don't know, a little like grown up in Brian. Because ordinarily you'd think that Brian would just kick him out, say, hit the road, kid. Wear it home proudly.
But he understood to take him back to his, let's just go with parents at this point.
Yeah.
It's going to happen. And I like that Hunter defends Brian and saying like, I made the choice. Brian didn't make me do anything. I was the one who was like, I just want to help.
He was sexualized at an early age. Hunter all of a sudden was like very, very smart.
It went beyond street smart. It was like, you are very savvy and very in tune with what you're doing on the street, why you're doing it. And you absolutely 100% understand the implications of doing what you're doing.
Brian didn't understand the implications at all. So he takes his bag of jizz to Horvath at the police station. This story started to bother me, though. As you can tell, I'm a Law and Order fan.
Womp womp.
So Brian delivers this thing and says, take it to the lab and test it. But there's obviously no chain of custody. So they can't do anything with that jizz anyway. Also, it is like a clue for Carl to, not even a clue, like a compass heading, like, okay, I got to look deeper into this guy. So I just thought that was a little just goofy.
Yeah, and it's really funny because I did describe it as this is Law and Order SVU level shit. Because we are at least then given a big bombshell is that Reichert and Stockwell were partners for years.
Well, this is the thing that I also had a problem with. I'm surprised that Carl gave up so much information to Brian when just last episode, he wouldn't even give Debbie the time of day. And then he brings the DNA test results to Debbie and Brian in the diner.
I mean, are we to assume that he's had a crisis of faith or something and he's had an awakening that I need to do the right thing and not just...
Oh, yeah, totally fair. But I don't think that a policeman should be going and informing civilians of the status of his investigation.
No. Well, the case is cold case. So it's not an active investigation. So then it makes me wonder, what are the rules around that?
Well, Brian puts on his rage cape and yes. goes to confront Reichert at the bar. And I'm like, seriously? It's like, Brian, hon, he killed somebody. And you want to go like poke the hornet's nest at the bar?
And it got like physical.
Yeah.
Like Reichert like grabs and shoves him and tells him to shut the fuck up. And the bar like did nothing.
Yeah, I wrote that down too. It was nobody cared.
Nobody gave a shit.
It's like the scene in Airplane in the bar fight where everybody's just going about their business. The lesbians yes. are tearing up the bar.
Everyone's just picking up their drinks.
Continue well, there's visual. Something else that Brian did here that I didn't like is that he directly put Hunter into danger by identifying him as the source.
Yes, he said that guy you picked up. And it was like,
yeah.
Reichert could easily find him. If Hunter's deciding like, oh, I need to go out and hustle for the night, Reichert knows what he looks like,
yeah.
knows where the hustlers are, and he can go and just make him another Jason Kemp.
Brian just gave Reichert all this privileged information that Carl had given him, directly putting everybody involved in danger.
Yes, you know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of how like the villain explains everything in their plot to the hero just before being yeah. thwarted.
Since I'm going to kill you, I will explain it all to you.
And in no way are you going to somehow escape and and win.
Yeah, that was Austin minutes. Powers played that out too.
Absolutely.
Begin the unnecessarily slow-moving dipping mechanism.
So I couldn't figure out what Brian's endgame was by saying, okay, Reichert, here's my entire plan right. to get you to confess that you murdered Jason Kemp.
And here's where I got all the information if you want to go after the sources.
He can be found at this address, and he's usually here at that time.
And Carl Horvath, Detective Carl Horvath, you can find him at the Liberty Street yes. precinct. So Brian's next stop is Stockwell's office?
Yes, Stockwell asked for him.
Are you offering me my job back?
I'm offering you a future. There's a lot I can do, even more than before.
How's that?
You always wanted my backers for your client list. I can still deliver them. And now you can keep them all to yourself.
So Stockwell basically tries to bribe Brian into silence. Wouldn't this story have been much more interesting if Stockwell threatened to have Reichert kill Brian? Instead, he's making these little innuendos about money. How about you just say, yeah, that guy that you were with at the bar, he's a scary dude. He's armed and he knows who you are. Watch it or else.
I think that's an interesting take, but the way
yeah, see?
I thought that was a very interesting take, but I saw it as very much like trying to make a literal deal with the devil. There was a really chilling sense.
Oh, you thought Brian might go for it?
Not that he would go for
it. Oh, wait, maybe he should have.
Well, I don't think Brian was ever going to go for it, but there was a real chilling vibe around Stockwell because he was so calm, cool, and collected, willing to apologize for having Brian lose his job at Gardner Vance and saying, I'm willing to give you all of my clients. And there was like a smirk on Stockwell's face because I think Stockwell believes he's won. So I'm going to go ahead and give Brian the devil's deal to put him in my corner just to solidify everything, to show that I can buy everyone.
Wouldn't it have been better if he killed him?
I think that would have been a very obvious choice. And I think Stockwell knows that he could use Brian to his advantage.
Yeah, maybe I'm just a little too wrapped up in like the Dixon Hill private dick noir.
Yes, private big dick thing. Yes. And I think Stockwell's like, if I have this influential gay man in my corner, I have that entire group.
And I also solved my dumpster boy Kenneth Reichert problem.
Yep.
Why do you think Brian looked so devastated when Carl tells him that Reichert killed himself? Seems like this was Brian's moment of cowboy justice, like mission accomplished.
Well, and again, that also plays into how I think Stockwell knows that he has the ace in the hole because Reichert's dead. So the people that could have confirmed what Brian is accusing Reichert of.
There are none.
There are none.
Yeah.
So Stockwell has effectively won because no one will be able to 100% confirm because the two people that know are both dead.
That's a very good point.
And that's what makes the whole thing terrifying. And something that I really applaud this episode for, that's why I'm surprised it had a somewhat lower rating than the last couple of episodes. We're finally treated to a storyline that isn't neatly tied up and also is very Law and Order SVU.
It just goes to credits. You hear street noise in the background. You never know what happened. You're left to fill in the blanks.
And something I also really loved about the diner scene was that Horvath was still not moving on the Kim case, and he makes such a great point in saying that this is bigger than just him, is that he could be a dead man. That speaks to the level of corruption that exists in the city, and it helps Horvath's case of why he hasn't moved the way Debbie or Brian have expected him to move, to be this noble man. He's like, I could be killed. And that's saying that, like, we don't know how deep a level of corruption really exists in the Pittsburgh PD. And that's fascinating and gives us stakes to worry about Carl and why we're I don't want to say okay, but now understand his position of not wanting to move on Reichert right away.
Still queer as folk.
Like what you hear? Be sure to subscribe and rate us on iTunes. We like those 5 stars.
Still queer as folk. There's more on the way. We have another listener question from our friend Elena. Let's listen to that question real quick.
Hi, this is Elena, and I wanted to talk to you specifically about Brian's character. I think the writers repeat the same trick with him throughout the series. Brian's friends think that he's heartless all the time, but we, the audience, see why he's doing certain things. And by Gale's acting, we see Brian inside. We see his fragile nature by mimics, by his looks, by some tiny movements. And we get mad at people around him who do not see what is shown to us, people on this side of the screen. And I think this is the main secret why this character is so attractive. They repeat this trick again and again, and it works every time. And every time the audience goes like, oh, poor Brian, he's hurt, no one understands him. So do you agree that the charming nature of this character is built on this contrast between what Gale shows by his acting to the audience and what other characters of the show seem not to notice? They catch me with this all the time, although I clearly see what they're doing and how they're doing. But every time I go like, oh, poor Brian, no one understands him. Don't you feel the same way? And how can you be so critical and cruel to him? The ending of season 3 clearly shows what kind of person he is. Well, thanks for listening. Thank you for your work. I'll be waiting for season 4.
Thank you, Elena, for your question. I have to admit, I don't find Brian charming.
I do.
I know I have to be in the minority in this. I think Elena makes a great point in that, yes, we are seeing the perspective of Brian's motives on a lot of his choices and knowing that what he's trying to do is eventually really for the greater good, and he's willing to take the heat for it, and all the other characters really lambast him. Like, again, we get 2 or 3 airplane moments against Brian. But I still find him infuriating when I'm like, you chose to go this route with trying to help your friends, but you chose the asshole route. And I'm sure there were 2 or 3 other more subtle ways you could have handled this.
I feel like a lot of it's just this strange notion of the way that they write the character. As Blair Fell was telling us when we talked to him in season 2, he was a writer on the show. Cohen and Littman had a kind of Nietzsche view of Brian Kinney as the Superman. And sometimes the writing would come across as just unbelievable. he would at times be a character that you can empathize with, and at other times be, like you were saying, infuriating. So I don't think that it really did good service to the character to treat him that way. In seasons one and two, we saw a lot of vulnerability in Brian, and in those moments, we were a little more open to him.
Yes.
But when he is like the Superman, we're just kind of like, ugh.
Yeah. Who would find that attractive? Who would find that appealing? Like, I see those kinds of people, and if they try to come at me, I'm like, I don't know what you want out of me, because I'm not buying it. Thank you again, Elena, for your question. I think you make an excellent point in that Gale Harold is definitely working with the writing that he is given, and he absolutely leans into it when it comes to his portrayal of Brian, and that his overall intentions are for the greater good. But a lot of times the journey to get him there just pushes me so far that I oftentimes side with the other characters.
Thanks again for your question. If you want to ask us a question that we can answer on the air, you can go to stillqueerasfolk.com/hello and you can leave a voicemail that we'll play on the air, or you can leave a written question that we can read out loud for you.
Still Queer as Folk.
Ted and Emmett. Oof. This gross chemsex scene with Ted and Emmett was really startling.
It was just sad and hard to watch.
But at the same time, slightly hot at first. So you see it and you're like, ooh. And then you're like, ooh.
Yes, because our first introduction to it is Emmett is getting it from Ted. But Emmett has no joy.
Teddy.
I'm not done yet.
I know. We've been going at it for hours. And I never thought I'd hear myself say this, but I think I need a rest.
Here, take some more.
No, I don't want any more.
I'm still having trouble with Emmett being so indulgent of Ted's addict behavior, though, because I would have ended things at so many points.
Yes, Emmett is still apologizing and still trying to justify what Ted is going through. But when you see how Ted is acting while insanely high on these drugs.
Yeah, well, it's like,
what are you doing?
Right. Break and glass in emergency, calling all cars.
And I thought Emmett's logic for joining Ted in the chem sex by doing crystal himself, I thought was so warped. I mean, that is putting your partner in such a dangerous position and saying, I'm going to do this with you once because I love you, but then I'm never going to do it again because I need you to understand that if I was willing to do this for you, I want you to be willing to leave this behind.
Yeah, that's where the writing fell apart for me, because I don't do things that I don't want to do. So I'm not going to use a dangerous street drug because my partner wants me to, if that goes against who I am. I'd be like, get the fuck out of here.
I'd be like, you need help.
Yeah.
And I'm willing to get you that help. But until you get that help, in no way are we going to spend any more time together like that. No.
I like your answer better than mine, which was, get the fuck out. You're the grown up in the room.
And that rarely happens, folks. So when I mean it, you know it's trouble.
There's something here that I bumped on too, which is Michael is pretty uppity about Emmett and this crystal use, especially considering that he's snorted all kinds of shit up his nose with Brian.
So he used crystal, okay? I mean, he's hardly the only one. I'm sure half the people in this community have tried it.
I haven't.
Well, if you had, maybe you'd realize it's not such a big deal.
Are you saying, don't tell me? You didn't.
It just happened.
Taking crystal does not just happen.
I thought that if I did it with him, he would know that I'm not being judgmental or disapproving like everyone else. Okay, that he would trust me and know that I love him. So that when I asked him to stop, he would.
I just thought it was a little strange that Michael was so righteous about it all and
Well, he is a parent now, and he doesn't.
Yeah, but I just wish that Michael might have spoken more from past experience that he's had and gone on record as saying, I've moved beyond the hard drugs. It's just marijuana now, or something like that.
Or the occasional poppers.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a thing that they love to do with Michael, is give him some sort
reinvent
of,
him.
Well, somehow give him this moral high ground.
Right. Yeah.
It's like, but not two episodes ago, we saw you do this. What are you talking about?
He and Brian used to be doing this on the dance floor, in the stalls, in the bathroom.
Well, that was in their 20s. They grew up since then.
This Emmett Ted lunch was so sad.
Like, what the fuck? Like, that's all I kept thinking. Like, you can clearly see that Ted is tweaked.
He's so far gone at this point.
Absolutely. Like, and he's, like, chewing gum and he can't sit still. And, like, I think it's also really interesting that his hair is sort of flared out the way it is, as if he has static shock right now.
The messy look.
Yes. Clearly mirrors the Doc look. Because Doc also has that sort of look, and it's very strange. He then forces Emmett to plan a party for him. And like Emmett was so forceful and so standing and so good at staying his ground when he said, I did it with you once and I will never do it again.
Oh, we do a little Tina.
Since when are we on a first name basis with illegal substances?
You loved it too.
You know what? I didn't love it. I only did it to make you happy and I'm never doing it again.
It's starting to get annoying that Emmett just keeps playing along with this.
Yes, like, I don't understand it.
Emmett, you should be organizing the intervention, not like planning a dinner party for the meth heads. And what kind of a party was that anyway?
Well,
boy, did he read the guest list wrong.
Exactly. And then there's this last line that wraps up this insane restaurant scene when Ted makes his demand about the party.
So what kind do you want?
Oh, I don't know. Small, intimate affair tomorrow night for, say, six of my closest friends. So everything must be perfect. Am I making myself clear?
Crystal clear.
Excellent.
It was like the writers couldn't help themselves. Like, we're going to do a big nudge, nudge, wink, wink at the audience by landing this line. And I'm like, do you get it?
I don't think Ted got it, which is, I think, the interesting part. He's just like so...
He's so fucked up. Yeah. You understand? And that's where, like you said, I was expecting it to be an intervention. He's like, yes, I'm going to plan your party. And then there's everybody saying, Ted, what the fuck are you doing? You need help.
There was a very rare thing that came up here, and that's a Dr. David Cameron reference.
How was the sofa?
There's a good chiropractor when you need one. Sorry.
This was a super rare occurrence where Dr. David Cameron is mentioned outside of season one. I think we've only had two.
I am in shock. I didn't even think about that. Patrick is looking at me like my mouth is dropped. That is insane. I can't believe I did not pick up on that.
Yeah, you locked up. You had your Matt had his hands up on his face. His eyes were wide open and he was just kind of inhaling going, because Dr. David Cameron.
Mind blown. That is... Yes, that's a good, well, apparently good chiropractors are, I guess, in Oregon.
Which is interesting because when that came up, I immediately unlocked from this episode and started to think, God, season one had like some great writing, great stories, great arcs, most of them originally pioneered by Russell T. Davies.
Yep.
And now we have this. And so I was kind of yearning for season one. I don't know. I see season one of Queer as Folk, it was always, I think, the best season, even though we talked about it from a critical standpoint as a total train wreck. But I think about those stories and I think about the events and they just resonate a little bit better with me than like these grown-up stories.
Oh, I see. I still can't get over the crystal party. Like, so we know that Emmett has quietly exited while Ted lit up the pipe.
Yeah.
And the orgy was basically happening. Like, I love the fact there was one guy that said, well, let's make ourselves a little more comfortable. He just takes off his shirt and starts making out with someone.
Oh, Alex Chappell shot this so well. This orgy.
Like, Emmett, what the fuck do you think was going to happen? Of course, they're all going to do a bunch of drugs and have crazy anonymous sex. Like, what were you expecting? That's why I was shocked that he was actually planning a actual party.
Yeah, that's interesting you say that. What did you really expect? Like a sit-down dinner? I mean, the minute Dr. Mark?
Mark, yes. Yeah,
the devil. Dr. Mark the Devil comes in. He's making fun of the party. So like right off the bat, he's throwing barbs and throwing shade and spilling tea at Emmett.
Look at you.
My squad taught me that. And right away, you just know that this is going sideways. And I felt a whole bunch of compassion for Emmett because Emmett does his best in this case. He puts all this effort into it and it's immediately not even recognized. And in fact, it's made fun of. And if you've ever been in that position where you go out of your way for somebody and they're just so oblivious and condescending about it.
They're just mocking him and everything that he's laid out. And I was, it was just hard to watch.
The next day when Emmett comes back to face Ted, this scene was amazing. The lighting is blindingly bright and flat. Everything in the room is desaturated, yes. Mm-hmm. But it's bright. Ted's all anemic looking. The apartment's all tore up from
sex and drugs and who knows what else.
Through this entire scene, I don't know if you noticed this, but we hear this clock incessantly ticking in the background.
I guess I didn't pay attention to that because I was so enthralled with how it looked. Because you're right, all the color was flushed out of the scene. Especially when we saw Ted take the hit from the pipe and he went into that golden, bright look that we've seen before when he was in the hotel.
And the next day, there's nothing.
Yeah, to see it all drained was such a smart visual cue to let us know that the party has died down and that it has left Ted.
And Dr. Mark has to go to surgery to do a tonsillectomy.
In an hour.
Yeah.
And the fact that he says that it's all moderation, I was like...
He does seem to be like one of those high-functioning drug addicts that's terrifying. Really can do this.
But this whole scene was so heartbreaking to watch. And the fact that Ted, while high on drugs, somehow managed to lucidly explain why he's doing what he's doing.
Oh, it's great. He goes after Emmett. He's not just explaining himself. Mm-hmm. He just goes right for the jugular. And
he tears into Emmett.
We hear where the title of the episode came from.
Since when did you get so fucking superior? You think because you put a piece of cheese on a cracker, you pawn it off a sheep, that somehow you're better than everyone. Well, let me tell you something. No matter how many fancy parties you give or how much money they give you to give them, you'll always be a piece of trash from Hazelhurst, Mississippi.
I don't need you to tell me that, because I tell myself that every day. But at least I am not a tweaked out, fucked out crystal queen.
This entire scene was amazing. It's like some of the best acting of the season is here, and it was matched with really good writing.
Yeah, and it's because this is such a completely fucked situation, but we're seeing a real couple have real problems, and we're not seeing an easy resolution for them. Both are going to lose in this moment.
That moment where Ted's talking about how he just hated himself and who he used to be, you know, the quiet accountant and everything. It was terrifying. It was so good.
Yeah, this was a highlight of both Scott Lowell and Peter Page delivering what's going on for these characters.
This was a very pivotal moment in the entire series arc too. This is where Ted totally changes who he is.
Yeah.
This is the moment where Ted hits this tipping point of his addiction, and it was very, very masterfully played.
I don't need you criticizing me and making me feel like shit. Okay? I am beautiful. Everything is beautiful. And if you don't see it that way, you can just get the fuck out.
So after being kicked out, Emmett winds up at Hunter's birthday party. I like this because the opposites between happy, surprised, youthful Hunter and Emmett, older, devastated because of Ted. Ted's like night and day different than Hunter. It was just very striking. I thought that was really good writing there to introduce this scene after seeing such an awful scene.
Yes, and I liked the quiet moments between Michael and Emmett in this. Like, they managed... I feel like a second season, Michael would have, like, exploded the whole party by saying things really loud.
Normally he does.
Yeah, normally he does. And Michael just steps up and takes on the role of being the understanding friend and saying, I'm going to be the one here for you. And then and I really love this, that Mel and Lindsay were there to pick up the pieces and say, I'm sorry what I said, and I want you to stay with us. We understand what you are going through. And it was really beautiful to see that reconciliation happen the way.
This was something that I didn't like about the scene.
Oh.
Melanie tells Emmett that he's not a silly faggot for standing by his partner.
You were right. I am just a silly faggot.
No. What's going on? You stood beside your partner, no matter what anyone said. And that makes you a very loyal, very brave faggot.
I have totally got to disagree with that. I think Emmett totally was a silly faggot for standing by Ted through all this and for so long. I don't like that Melanie let it go under the auspices of standing by the drug addict. I think Melanie's line needed to be revised a little bit to say, yes, you saw that he was a drug addict. You were doing your best. Something like that. Instead of saying, no, it's okay. You stood by your partner. But
well,
you are a silly fag. You saw this coming, Emmett. We talked about this in this episode about how we just couldn't believe that he just kept going and going and going with
it. Yes, I will agree with
that. And
that's
not okay. He shouldn't be praised for that. He should be talked to. Got to sit him down. And say, look, you can't put up with this. You have to stand up and say, no, I am enough. You are fucked up, tweaked out, Crystal Queen. Get away from me.
I think in this moment, though.
Thank you.
Mel, I want to counter what you're saying in that. I'm sure Mel could have easily have been like, I know you're going to hate hearing I told you so, but I told you so.
Told you so, told you so, told you so.
She acknowledges that clearly. He has gone through the hurt that, as his friend, she would not have wanted him to go through, but he has gone through it. And he has learned a very, very, very hard lesson. So what am I going to do? I'm going to be the friend that is there for him, and then I'm going to help him out any way I can.
I just feel like Hunter would have known better. Hunter's 15. He turned 16
He's
here.
16, yeah.
So I just thought it was odd praise to hear from Melanie, who previously was such an anti-drug person. She was, I don't believe him. He's a fucking drug user. He's going to lie to you. He's going to abuse you. He's going to take advantage of you. Oh my God. Look, he did.
But she's acknowledging the tough position that Emmett would have
had. Yeah. Maybe it was just
saying that, like, I know you were being loyal to him. You were being loyal to your partner. And I understand that. Now let's focus on you.
Maybe it was just clumsy writing. I like the way that you described it better. I think if Ephraim Seeger could have written this a little bit more sentimentally.
Yes.
It would have been better because Emmett, he needs to be slapped around a little bit here.
A little, yes.
It's like, dude.
Still queer as folk.
Okay, so Justin has a token appearance in this episode. And we see him in his underwear to start out with.
Yes.
And then we see him at the Pittsburgh Institute of Fine Art, who's going to discipline Justin unless he apologizes to the disciplinary committee. That doesn't seem like too much to ask, right?
Right. To say, I know I acted in a way that goes against what the school stands for, and for that I apologize. And that's fine, and I like that the implication here is don't let it fuck up your academics. Go. It's one of those things like better to act and ask for forgiveness.
True.
You know? And I'm like, that's fine, that's cool. But when he goes in front of the disciplinary board and they switch it up on him, I then understand his position in saying, I did what you asked of me. Now you are asking me to apologize to someone who fundamentally disagrees with who I am as a person. Go fuck yourself.
He's already taken away my right to assemble, my right to fuck, my...
This is not about you being gay.
You're right. It's not. It's about freedom of expression as a person and an artist without fear of censure or reprisal. That's why I will not apologize to him. Here or under any other circumstance.
Props to Justin for standing up for it.
Oh, absolutely.
And refusing to apologize. Yeah, I mean, he gave a great art school student speech, but I...
Oh, it was so good.
I couldn't believe that an art school would actually be saying those types of things. And
yeah, what the fuck?
This made me curious about why that Steve Jobs-looking dean wasn't in the scene that was in season two, was it?
Oh, when after he had been injured. And
yeah, and he almost got kicked out of school for not being able to hack it. This was like a totally different school all of a sudden. Maybe it's like that guy should have come back.
Maybe that guy retired.
Yeah.
I have a new dean.
The old dean was already identified as being somewhat villainous. So why wouldn't you bring this character back?
Yes, and here, there was something about the way he said, you're also going to apologize to Chief Stockwell, drink water. And I was like, creepy, what the fuck?
There's an interesting line from Justin.
So you sacrifice everything. Sometimes you have to for what you believe in.
He definitely didn't feel that way back earlier in the season when Ethan was being asked to play it straight.
Oh.
So sometimes you sacrifice everything for what you believe in, unless your name is Ethan Gold and you play the violin.
Maybe in Justin's head here, he sacrificed. I'm trying to justify it. And I think you make a great point.
That was this season.
That was literally just.
Yeah.
That was not 8 episodes ago.
Exactly. And poor Ethan, whatever happened to that kid?
Who the fuck knows?
Our friend the mailman took a picture of a kid playing the violin in the CTA, the Chicago subway. And he sent me this the picture and a message. It's like, I think I just found Ethan Gold in the subway. And then, of course, right away, the CTA personnel drag him out because you have to have a permit to play down there.
Oh, well.
So we have a few Hunter loose ends to tie up here. Hunter didn't have so much a major role in this episode other than being the jizz delivery boy.
And that swinging condom.
Yeah.
I was going to say, Riker shot a big load.
Oh, I didn't think it was that big.
I mean, it wasn't the buckets that that one guy
That's
shot.
That's right.
But, you know.
It's interesting that Michael is now defending Hunter and Ben wants to cast him off because they aren't getting there anywhere with him.
Maybe he'd be better off with someone else.
There isn't anyone else. It's just us.
And we're in over our heads, thanks to me, because I had to save the world.
Not the world, just one kid.
Michael, we're not helping him. And what's more, he doesn't want our help. So I think we should just admit our failure and let him go.
They really aren't doing anything to dissuade the young man to change. They don't make him go to school. They are never putting any consequences in place to his actions. They never discipline him. They don't set any rules. So, of course, he's going to keep doing what he's doing.
They're not saying any
rules. The only
rule
is come home at midnight.
And they pointed out that what their approach was in baby steps. They can't say, okay, we're going to enforce all these things on you.
They don't even know his last name at this point.
Exactly. So that's why it's baby steps. And they're like, let's at least start with, okay, you have to be here at midnight. We're going to give you a key so we can start introducing the steps of responsibility to him.
He met all of that until he had the high school principal with his pants down on the sofa.
Right. Allowing the high school principal to blow him.
Right. So, I don't know. It just seemed like Ben all of a sudden just gave up for not even really trying that hard.
You don't think he tried?
I don't know. It's like they were still...
I mean, they committed fraud by saying that he was his uncle.
That's true. But they were still basically looking the other way when he was going out and hooking every night.
I think they were acknowledging that this has to be a part of his existence. And this is sort of their way of slowly bringing... Because, I mean, they have no legal hold on him.
Well, true. But the way that Ben was playing it off was, we're not doing him any favors. Let's cast him out.
I don't think they were casting him out.
That's what Ben wanted to do.
I don't think they wanted... They didn't want to.
Well, no, but Ben saw the inevitability that Hunter is still kind of the wild child. He hasn't been, like, domesticated or tamed.
We haven't been able to convince him that he needs to go back to school. He doesn't like it when we try to enforce even, like, a little bit of rules in our household for him. So... At what point do we say we can't save everybody?
Yeah, that's
and I like that it had to, Hunter had to hear that for him to understand, like, this is how good I have it right now. I need to reciprocate something because clearly these people are trying.
Yeah, I'm not so sure that I like the look of a cleaned up Hunter though. When then, you know, he'd washed his hair and it's like, first of all, dude, he's a hooker. He's washing his hair all the time. He's got to look good for these men. But they noticed he washed his hair. They cleaned him up, put him into some fresh baggy jeans.
Yes.
And a fresh baggy shirt. I like the scruffy punk. I didn't like that cleaned up punk.
He liked him slightly dirty, slightly used.
So that cute little birthday party that we talked about earlier, something I noticed there is that Gus was in this scene. We hadn't seen Gus in a long time.
He's
like a live
up?
Gus. Yeah. He's like a 2-year-old. They say he's a 2-year-old, but he looks a little older than that.
I think he looked more 4.
I did like Vic's little look that he threw at Debbie when Debbie's on the way out. Vic is just kind of going, oh. That was really cute.
At any time Vic shows up is a highlight for me.
So I guess the party, seeing all the love, meeting all the friends and family, and getting a Game Boy was enough for Hunter to stay in. and decide to go to school?
Yeah, I wanted to make sure it wasn't too much like, we're buying his love.
Yeah.
But I like to think that at least when he's like, oh, here are all these people who don't even know me and they're
embracing me.
They're embracing me.
They're embracing
me
the
in.
Hooker. I mean, I see where Seeger was going with the story here, but it just, like most things in Queer as Folk, it just seemed too easy.
Yes.
It was so easily resolved.
Well, and I do like that his answer was, I'll maybe go out later.
Yeah.
With the face on Ben and Michael's like, he's gonna stay.
Yeah, I did like that part though. I thought, oh, that's so cute. It's like, they're just gonna have like family night in and Ben will make some more like miso soup or tofu stir fry or something like that. No, it's the tofu stir fry that killed him, I think. I almost killed him. He ate that spicy food and it triggered pancreatitis.
Yes.
Was that last season or was that this season?
That was last season because that was right before he went into his hulking phase.
Oh, right. Okay, so let's talk hits and misses for this episode. What was your hit?
My hit is that we finally have a plot that isn't tied up in a nice little bow with Reichert's suicide before we believe justice is going to be served for Jason Kemp.
I'll talk about that in my miss.
Oh. But yes, I thoroughly enjoyed that it wasn't so, well, we found the killer, we're bringing him to justice, and that's the end, because finale.
Should I say my miss now instead of my...
Yeah, let's go ahead. Let's hear what your miss is.
Okay, so my miss was Brian the Private Dick. That was just so over the top for me. And again, I'll quote Aristotle here, which is probable impossibilities are to be preferred over improbable possibilities. It was just too improbable that Brian could single-handedly crack the Jason Kemp murder case, complete with DNA. And with Reichert's death, we still don't know why Jason Kemp was killed in the first place.
Well, and that's what I like. This is
you like that?
I like that it wasn't, there's no easy answer to this.
Okay. I
like that.
I can
that.
Go with that.
I like that there's no easy answer.
I felt like we needed to know why he like strangled the kid or whatever. Do we know how he died?
No.
He was just dead.
He was just dead in the dumpster.
Yeah, and like this, Melania's Law, Jason Kemp is dead.
This is the most Law and Order SVU you can get. Because oftentimes in that show, they may have identified the culprit and then the culprit meets an untimely demise.
It was kind of like putting Ralph Macchio in a movie where he doesn't do karate.
Side note, if you've never watched the YouTube series Cobra Kai, it's
it's so good.
It's pretty
it's great. I watched that too.
All right.
Wait, where were we?
So I gave my hit and you gave your miss because they tied together. So let me give my miss and then you can give me your hit. My miss is Emmett having to see Ted on his way to rock bottom. And that we discussed it. It just doesn't make any sense to us why Emmett would like allow Ted to go deeper and deeper and deeper into this hole. And even to the point where he was... I wanted to give Emmett more credit than allowing that party to go on. Like, as soon as that shirt came off and someone pulled out that pipe, I would have thought Emmett would be like, get the fuck out of this house.
I think another angle would have been, if this was pay TV in 2018, they would have had to have had Emmett join that and go a little bit deeper into it versus walking out.
Well,
it's like he needs to be exposed to some of this ilk.
So yeah, I don't think he would have walked out. I think he would have made that scene that then would have triggered Ted's lines about, well, you embarrassed me by throwing all my friends out. Why the fuck would you do that? It was my party. And then allowing that to explode into what we saw in that scene after the orgy would have been very interesting to watch.
It's interesting that that's one of your misses because my hit is kind of closely related to that. That final scene where Ted kicked Emmett out was my hit. Ephraim Seeger wrote snappy dialogue. Alex Chappell shot it perfectly. Peter Page and Scott Lowell delivered it astonishingly well. This was just this perfect confluence of all the different crafts and talents to bring this story to a really scary and believable crescendo. So I thought that this episode was unfairly rated really low by fans.
I do agree with that. While I think that the craftsmanship of the scene is so spectacular, it's the fact that we have to have that scene is why it's my miss.
Yeah. This has been episode 13 of season 3, Tweaked Out, Fucked Out, Crystal Queen.
Next time on the season 3 finale, Brian exposes Stockwell on the eve of the election.
Debbie rallies the troops on election day.
Ted hits rock bottom and Hunter's mom shows up demanding full custody.
You mean Ted hasn't hit rock bottom yet?
Apparently, he has to hit the rock to hit rock bottom.
He has to go to bedrock.
Yes.
That will be episode 14 of season 3, and it's called The Election.
We're on Twitter and Instagram at StillQueryF, and you can continue the discussion on Facebook at StillQueerAsFolk.
Find me on Instagram at Patrick Randall. Would love to connect with you.
And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at MatthewPD.
Thanks for joining us. If you enjoyed your time today, please give us a positive review or a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Till next time, I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Still Queer as Folk was produced by me, Patrick Randall, for Slightly Unbalanced. Matt Dominguez wrote and performed the show with me. Still Queer as Folk is made with love in Chicago.
Still Queer as Folk.